You're listening to the Cycling Podcast in association with Rafa. Rafa exists to improve your ride with the finest kit, inspiring stories, and vibrant clubhouses across the globe.
Hello, my name's Richard Boer, and I'm with Watford's Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Berlin's Daniel Freib.
Hello.
How are you, fellas? Daniel, Lionel, you are also... You ventured far from your Watford home today, have you not?
I am. I'm in the Brussels bureau this week. I've been on a secret mission in Belgium, and I've ended up in a hotel in Brussels near the railway station, waiting for my train home.
Dun-dun-dun. We get in trouble. That's a little clue there about your secret mission. That's for a forthcoming Friends special.
Is it not for our forthcoming copyright lawsuit that usually kicks in around the Giro time? No.
Yeah, I had a quote for how much it would cost to use the music I want to use in the episode, and it is way out of our budget, unfortunately.
No, that's a shame. I know. I'll just do it in the style of how I've just done it. Well, we're speaking on Wednesday afternoon. We've just watched Flesh Wallone. It followed a slightly different script to previous years, which means I can't use my Gary Lineker quote, "Football is a simple game, 22 men chase a ball for 90 minutes, and at the end the Germans always win." There was a similar quote to be said about Flesh Wallone and Alejandro Valverde, but he didn't win today. And we've also got the Amstel Gold Race to talk about. We'll look ahead to Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and we'll talk a little bit about the Tour of the Alps, which is ongoing. But before any of that, Lionel, can we have the weekly news roundup, please?
We can indeed, yes. So, well, it's another big racing week. The weekend was the Amstel Gold Race. The men's race was won by Michael Valgren of Astana. He's been on great form this spring. He won Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, remember, a few weeks ago. He really took the bull by the horns at the Amstel Gold Race, and he beat former winner Roman Kreuziger and twice former winner Enrico Gasparotto, who tried to bridge across the gap on the run-in, but I think even if he'd made it, he wouldn't have had enough to beat Valgren's sprint. A really impressive victory by the Astana rider. A very cagey, tactical race, a lot going on. It was one of those ones where if you went out the room for 5 minutes and came back, you really had no clue what was going on. Peter Sagan was in the mix, but he looks like he's the man to mark, isn't he, in the rainbow jersey. He ended up fourth, Alejandro Valverde fifth, and then it was Tim Wellens and Julian Alaphilippe. The women's race was won by Chantal Black ahead of Lucinda Brand. The Dutch riders continue to bring home big results. Today was Flesh Wallone, another Dutch win there for the women. Anna van der Breggen won for the fourth year in a row ahead of Ashley Moorman-Passio, one of the contributors to the Cycling Podcast book, A Journey Through the Cycling Year. And Megan Guarnier, who isn't a contributor to the Cycling Podcast book, but was third nevertheless.
The men throwing her hat into the ring
for you made that sound slightly controversial.
Oh, why not?
There was some terrible international incident that took place.
No, I don't think as they crossed the line, you know, there was any sort of fallout about having contributed or not contributed to the Cycling Podcast book. As prestigious as an honour as this will no doubt turn out to be in future years, no doubt. The men's Flesh Wallone, as you say, Richard, Valverde had won 100 years in a row, but didn't win this year. He was in the right position, but Julian Alaphilippe was just too strong. I was watching on Belgian TV, and the commentator said, "Timing ist alles," which I assume mean timing is everything. Absolutely right. But Julian Alaphilippe. He went earlier than you would conventionally have said you need to go. He actually sort of pulled the rug from under Alejandro Valverde's feet somewhat. The other impressive ride on the Muir de Huy was Jelle Vanendert, who has got a really good record in Amstel Gold and Flesh Willow, and particularly, I just remember that he won sort of like a bolt out of the blue, a Tour de France stage at Luzardiden in 2011, but that was a good result for Lotto Soudal, who've not had the best of springs so far. We'll talk about Flesh Willow, obviously. The other race you mentioned there, the Tour of the Alps or Giro del Trentino. I'm surprised Daniel's not spitting feathers.
No,
about this
I've
kind of
well, I've reconciled myself to this, and it's actually a completely different race, isn't it? I mean, it's the same time slot, more or less the same part of the world, but it goes spends more time in Austria, and there's a sort of a bi-national organisation to this race, and I think there's a part of the organising committee is Austrian, part is Italian. So, different race.
Well, the Astana team, who are not Austrian, they're Kazakh, but they've got off to a flyer. They won the first two stages. Pello Bilbao López de Amencia won stage one ahead of his teammate, Luis Leon Sanchez, and stage two was won by Miguel Angel López ahead of Thibaut Pino. Another up-and-coming Colombian to take note of, Ivan Ramiro Sosa, one of Androni's, the latest on the production line. Daniel, you may be able to talk a bit about this, but riding for the small Italian team, owned and run by...
Gianni Savio. Friend of the podcast, Gianni Savio, who celebrated his 70th birthday just a couple of days ago.
The Silver Fox. So Ivan Ramiro Sosa, he was in the lead last I checked. Chris Froome's back.
No, Thibaut Pino is now in the lead, Lionel. Oh, breaking news.
Goodness me. Well, Chris Froome was fourth on that particular stage, and obviously he is building up to the Giro d'Italia at the start of next month. Meanwhile, over in northwest France, or Brittany to be more precise, Jonathan Hivert won the Tour de Finistère ahead of Romain Bardet. And Christophe Laporte won a race that's very close to my heart, having ridden the Sportive a couple of years ago, Trobro-Lyon, which is on all of the sort of farm tracks, the ribbing. And another little bit of news, Mark Cavendish will be back racing at the Tour de Yorkshire, which clashes with the opening weekend of the Giro.
Did you mention there that Ben O'Connor won today's stage at the Tour of the Alps, 22-year-old Australian on Dimension Data?
I didn't, but you're doing the breaking news, obviously.
You're out of the loop. You're out of the loop a bit there, Lionel. But that was a very, very good win for him ahead of
and it's very much needed for that team. They're having a bit of a torrid time at the moment.
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, no, very, very much needed. And he's ridden really well so far this week, and looks like a great prospect, tall, rangy sort of rider, but he rode extremely well, went with about 7 kilometres to go and held them off, so a very, very good win for him and for that team.
I think breaking news roundup by Richard Moore is required this week, because I've had terrible connectivity issues here. You'd think in the kind of bureaucratic capital of Europe, Brussels, that you'd be able to get online easily, but I had to watch Flesh Willone on a moody feed in sort of 6-second snatches. It was quite a hard watch, but it was worth it. It was actually an enjoyable old race.
The RAFA Cycling Club is the largest global community of its kind. Members share their passion for the road through rides, events, exclusive club kits, and racing. Find out more at rafa.cc.
Thank you very much to our main sponsor, RAFA. And this week's RAFA news is that they have just launched their 2018 City Collection, updated City Collection, just in time for summer. And it does actually feel like summer now. It's very hot here in London today. I've been out on my bike, actually, this morning. The City Collection is designed for on and off the bike, days spent in the sunshine with specially developed fabrics that let the air in and wick sweat away. View the collection online, that's at rafa.cc. or in any of the RAFA clubhouses that are, of course, throughout the world. Now, Flesh Willone, Julian Alaphilippe, he has gone close in that race before. Another guy who's gone close before, Dan Martin, well off the pace today, and it continues a very difficult start to his season in a new team. But Alaphilippe, the best goatee beard in the peloton since Fabio Baldato.
I'm not a big fan of the goatee beard generally as a look. Not a big fan of Alaphilippe's either. However, no, not at all.
Are you
no.
not? Are you not? Why not?
I don't know. There's something sinister about them. I don't really trust people with goatee beards. It's like I don't trust people.
Hang on. But what about Alaphilippe? Is there something sinister about him?
No, I wouldn't necessarily say that, Rich. Anyway, moving swiftly on. Alaphilippe, he'd had 2 second places in this race, hadn't he? And we've often said, I think, that the Mur de Huy is a climb that you need to get the measure of over a couple of years. And Lionel mentioned the Belgian commentators talking about the timing. And I think, you know, it takes a couple of years to get that right. I thought that Dan Martin was sort of has been tapering towards the point where he was going to get it just right. But again, yeah, a disappointing day for him. But Alaphilippe, he's taken a while to win the first one, or his first Ardennes Classic, but we've seen this coming for a few years. I mean, the first time I came across him, 2014 at the Ride London Classic, and he finished third. And I don't think I'd ever heard of the guy then, but I remember speaking to Brian Holm, the Quickstep DS, after the finish there, and he very matter-of-factly said, well, yeah, Alaphilippe is the next big thing, isn't he? And I said, well, I don't know, Brian, I never heard of the guy. But then, sure enough, the next spring he popped up, finished second in Flesh and second again last year, or the year after that, and yeah, he won today.
I'm surprised to hear there Daniel doesn't like...
I didn't say I didn't like him. I don't like his goatee beard. It's just one of those... I've got a bit of a blind spot about that. It's a bit like people who eat eggs. I don't know if we've been through that before. I don't trust people who eat eggs. But anyway, go on.
Well, as a bearded man who eats eggs, I think Julian Alaphilippe's terrific. I mean, he's punchy. He's explosive, but he can... I mean, you know, last year... third in Milan-San Remo, you know, in some really good company, looking good in week-long stage races. He had a bad crash at the Tour of the Basque Country this time last year, or a little bit earlier than this last year, which ruled him out, obviously, of the Ardennes Classics. And, of course, the Tour de France, it wasn't until July, August that he actually came back to racing. So, he's had to... miss a big chunk of a season when he just was moving into the phase where you'd think, well, he's going to start bagging some of these big wins. Second at Il Lombardia last year, of course, behind Vincenzo Nibali. I mean, distant behind Nibali, to be fair, that day. I don't think he was really in the same class. But, he started well this season, and... It was all the thing that was interesting today was the timing of that move and the way that Quickstep again rode like a team. They had Shackman in the break. Then when they reached the Mur de Huy, Shackman is still off the front and looking pretty strong until they go through the sort of Z bend and then everything sort of ebbed away from him pretty dramatically, as it tends to do. But to put Valverde on the back foot as impressively as he did, you know, we can't underestimate the strength that requires. It was a really impressive win, and I think it does make him the man to watch on Sunday at Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
I mean, it was a hard race in Movistar. It was up to them to control it. Obviously, Mikel Landa did a lot of work. Vincenzo Nibali, as he did at the Tour of Flanders, and obviously Milan-San Remo, which he won. Really helped to animate the race and make it much harder. How significant was it that, I mean, I think it was significant that Quickstep had a man up the road. That certainly helped Alaphilippe. But how significant was it that, you know, we're seeing smaller teams in these races? Did that perhaps have an impact for Valverde? Because Valverde probably had to do a little bit more than...
I'm not sure if it's to do with the number of riders in the team, Rich, but certainly if you look at the strength of the teams today, I think Quickstep, as Lionel said, got it perfectly right, and they were sort of perfect on two fronts. Shackman was the last man to get caught, and I suppose Alaphilippe was just sitting a little bit more easily than some of the other guys in that group. Even halfway up the Mur de Huy, Quickstep could still kind of hedge their bets slightly, whereas Valverde had had a stressful hour. It was the onus was very much placed upon Movistar to chase the group that went away with Nibali in it with 45 kilometres to go. And I guess that had cost him a bit of nervous energy. I mean, although I think the last time a break won Flesh Willem, was it 2002 when Mario Aerts won? So, you know, we were pretty confident they would come back together. But there were various sort of tense moments in the last 15 kilometres where you thought, no, maybe they won't, maybe they'll stay away. And Movistar, of course, had no one in the break. And and Valverde was marooned in the peloton. So who knows? Maybe that like I say, bit of nervous tension just took the edge off Valverde's ascent of the Mur de Huy, and he wasn't lacking too much. I mean, he came very close to Alaphilippe, especially with about 100 meters to go, but then just realized that he wasn't going to make it.
It looked ominous, didn't it? But Alaphilippe, I wonder if he was riding Suisse, because didn't actually know that he was going for the win, apparently. I mean, he didn't celebrate, and that looked a bit strange because he's quite an exuberant fella. But apparently he wasn't sure that Nibali had been caught, so he wasn't absolutely 100% sure that he'd won. And you just wonder if that also has an effect in the way that you ride, and, you know, takes a little bit of pressure off, who knows.
I certainly think that the smaller team sizes does encourage perhaps stronger riders to go from a little bit earlier out. I mean, Nibali going in that move, I mean, it's a 100-to-1 shot, really. But the riders he was joined with, Benedetti, Kangert, Jack Haig, who also looked very strong, and Max Schachmann, who was obviously there to do a bit of policing, but also, you know, he's a good rider in his own right, as he proved on the climb. It does tease people out to play a bit, and that move took it seriously. They weren't just up the road kind of thinking, well, you know, we're going to get caught. They were actually out there trying to win the race, and it put the pressure on behind, and I think we really only saw the effects of that when they reached the bottom of the climb.
And I think, guys, that we mentioned the job that Landa did and how important that was, but it was a chasing job rather than a sort of teeing up job, whereas Alaphilippe had been teed up beautifully by Bob Jungels at the bottom of the Mur de Huy. He'd got a perfect lead out by a guy who is much more accustomed to and probably much more skilled in that role than someone like Landa. So again, Alaphilippe came in perfect shape.
Absolutely, because that group was actually pretty small. It was only, 25, 30 riders. I mean, we've seen much bigger groups than that come to the bottom, and obviously, you know, 50% of them are out the back door as soon as it gets steep. But this time, it was a smaller group, which just shows you the intensity of the chase and how much the pace was on to try and make sure that gap was closed so that the break didn't stay away to the bottom of the climb. Because although I was very confident that, you know, if it was anything under even 40 seconds going into the bottom of the climb, that a lead like that can evaporate just through the Z bend as they go up, you know, where it reaches its steepest part. So it was, you know, not necessarily well judged, but certainly the fact that that group behind was so small, it was fortunate for Alaphilippe that it all came back together.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
Time to tell you about this week's episode sponsor, and it's Beer 52 returning once again, because it turns out that quite a few of you like really good beer delivered to your door. Beer 52 is a monthly craft beer discovery club. They search out small batch craft beers from around the world, put a selection of 8 bottles in a box, and send it to you next day for only the cost of postage. Go to beer52.com/cycling to claim your box. As well as a beer, you get a snack and also a copy of Ferment magazine, which is a thick 100-pager featuring lots of articles and stories by good writers about the beer. And if you're a Beer 52 customer, you can tailor your order. So if you don't like dark beer, you don't have to have dark beer. Each month is a different theme. We've had Belgian and Irish beers previously on the Cycling Podcast, or I should clarify, offers for Belgian and Irish beers in conjunction with the Cycling Podcast. This month's beers are all from Amsterdam in the week of Amstel Gold Race. That seems appropriate. Among the breweries are Oedipus Brewing, Two Chefs Brewing, Posseat, Cater, and other breweries that I'd struggle to pronounce. To get 8 delicious Dutch beers, go to beer52.com/cycling. That's beer 52, the number 5 and the number 2. Next day shipping, and all it costs is £5.95 for postage. Well, Daniel, just on Flesh Wallonne briefly before we turn our attention back to Sunday and Amstel Gold Race, I do have to correct you. A little bit of fact-checking during the break there, the commercial break. Igor Astarloa was the last breakaway winner
who
of Flesh Wallonne in 2003.
Who could forget Igor Astarloa?
Well, oh, you of all people. Shame he didn't have a little goatee beard to make him easily
memorable. Still works. I'm sure we will see him at the Giro. He works as a driver for the organisation, I think. I think now lives in Italy.
I hope he doesn't see you. I hope he doesn't see you after that oversight.
Eek.
That could be ugly. Just before we move on to Amstel Gold Race, one little thing. You mentioned the news roundup, the women's Flesh Alone, and we will cover that at length next week in the April episode of the cycling podcast Femina. But I mean, we were there last year, Orla, Shinawi and I, and it's very disappointing that there's no TV coverage of the women's race, either Flesh Alone or Liège-Bastogne-Liège, both the ASO-organised races. Good coverage of Amstel Gold Race, an excellent race, actually, really good to watch, and great crowds. You know, the crowds are there all day for the men's and women's races, and it looked pretty special. Different finish for the women, actually, the old finish of the Amstel Gold Race for the women. It was a good race. So really, really disappointing that you cannot watch the women's race. And it was a cracking finish. I mean, I saw footage of the last kilometre of the women's race. Ashley Moulman-Passio has finished the top 10 in that race numerous times. It's the one that probably suits her best. And she had a really good go. And Anna van der Breggen has won that race four times in a row. This was as close as she's come, really, to being beaten. So it was a good, exciting finish, and Ashley Moulman-Passio is getting nearer and nearer to a really big win.
Rich, you mentioned how good the finale was in the women's race as well today. Have the two races today, the men's and women's, becalmed our clamour for a change to the Flesh Wallon finale, the uphill cheese roll?
It's interesting because we focus inevitably on the uphill cheese roll. The we think that the race, you know, all comes down to that, just a gallop up the climb. But of course, lots of other things go on in the race throughout the race that influence what happens at the end. And we spoke to Dan Martin for our friend special, which has just been released today, about Liège-Bastogne-Liège, and he talked a bit about Flesh Alone as well, and how in that race in particular, there's so many little things go on in that race that have a bearing on that sprint up the climb. We focus on the sprint. We shouldn't really, because, you know, we've talked about it already, but the fact that Nibali was up the road affected the race today. The fact that Quickstep had a man in the break had an effect on the race. You know, there lots of things happen throughout
the race. But that's the first time in 5 years that can be said, really. We didn't get the action replay finish of Valverde, who's won the last four, partly because the group was small going into the bottom, the chase was difficult and not as straightforward, and the identity of the riders up the road and the gap they got was significant. I mean, it was a far better addition going into the bottom, but let's not pretend it wasn't decided in the last 500 metres, because it was, but that's fine. But it was, there was more going on beforehand, which elevated it as a spectacle, certainly.
Okay, fair enough. Amstel Gold Race, Michael Valgren again. The numbers made a difference there, didn't they? In the Amstel Gold Races, Valgren had an Astana teammate with him up there in that group, and he had a couple of goes, Valgren, and eventually got away, and a very, very good win for him. Interesting to see Peter Sagan up there in fourth, you know, best of the rest, really. He is probably at the limit of his ability, but he looked pretty comfortable, I have to say. I mean, he was pretty, you know, he was close to winning.
I don't know, Rich. I'm not sure that Peter Sagan's ever going to win Amstel Gold.
You said that about Paris-Roubaix, and I think he didn't look particularly bothered. I don't mean that in a disrespectful kind of way, but I think having won Paris-Roubaix, I think, let somebody else take up the running. I mean,
whatevs.
I don't mean that he disrespected the race at all. I just think that, you know, he wasn't in the frame of mind to to really put absolutely everything on the line. I think he thought if it came back together and he was in there and he could have won a sprint, obviously he would have done so. But it didn't look like he was going to make it easy for somebody else to win the race. And I think, in a way, I kind of admire that, because the guys that got up the road, particularly Michael Valgren and Roman Kreuziger, you know, they really had to work very hard to do so, as did Enrico Gasparotto. You know, he seized an opportunity to get away and while everyone else was kind of watching and waiting. So Sagan took a little bit of a back seat, and perhaps, you know, in the back of his mind he was thinking, well, I won a bigger race than this last Sunday. I'm not going to make my legs and lungs hurt too much here.
He looked sort of liberated in a way. But Daniel Gasparotto, he's one of these riders, a bit like Simon Spielak at the Tour of Switzerland. You don't really hear much of him at other races, and it's just this one race that seems to bring out the best. See, how do you explain that? He's 36 years old.
The asparagus.
Now.
He comes into season for 1 week every April. Yeah, extraordinary.
Is this Enrico Gasparagus?
I wasn't even sure that he was still riding, to be honest. He obviously, loves the route and loves the finale. Although the finale has changed in the last couple of years, he's a punchy rider, and he has been a good rider. He's won the Italian national championships. He's got reasonable pedigree, but his results in Amstel Gold have been disproportionate to the rest of his palmarès. Another rider who obviously loves Amstel Gold race is Roman Kreuziger, who's having a bit of an Indian summer because he was, fourth today in Flèche Wallonne, wasn't he? Which was a surprise to me. Another rider who, we thought had been consigned to the role of Domestique nowadays, with the Yates brothers at Mitchelton Scott and Esteban Chavez. Last year we saw him mainly making the pace on climbs, but there's life in that old dog yet as well.
Is it possible to have an Indian summer in the spring? I guess it is. I guess so. I was just going to say the podium was like a sort of Madame Tussauds of Astana riders, a current Astana rider and two former Astana riders there, because I think Gasparotto won at least one of his Amstel Golds while riding for Astana, and Kreuziger, I think, also won while riding for Astana. Possibly wrong on that one. He won for Tinkoff, I think you're right, yeah. But all three former Astana riders. And I think that the fact that Valgren had Jakob Fuglsang in that leading group as well really helped. But take nothing away from Valgren's. You know, that was a really impressive move by him. More so, really, even than the victory at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad at the start of the spring. And showing some real kind of versatility there, a kind of a gnarly cobbly race and a long, long hilly one. Amstel Gold is not as tough as Liège-Bastogne-Liège, but 34 or 35 climbs in 260 kilometres, it's not a picnic, that's for sure.
And Rich, you mentioned Sagan, just to go back to him, as far as I was concerned, the big news from the weekend from his team was that Bora have renewed their contract, their sponsorship deal with the team, and going to go on for another couple of years, I think. And this surprised me, to be honest, purely because the whole story surprises me. I mean, it's a company that was started in 2007, and up until a few years ago, they only had about 10 employees. And to me, it's the classic sort of company that comes into professional cycling mainly to increase their visibility. And then after a couple of years, they've realized, particularly with a guy like Peter Sagan, they have probably fulfilled whatever goals they had in terms of visibility and brand recognition. And typically, those brands then get out. To have Bora renew its engagement in professional cycling is very good news, I think.
And just, finally, on Gasparagus, I've been looking out 7 times in the top 10 in Amstel Gold Race. It's quite a remarkable run.
There are riders like that, though, aren't they, that pop up every
strange,
year. You mentioned Simon Spielak always does well at the Tour of Romandy. I mean, it's just the way it is.
Or
I mean,
Switzerland.
What vegetable
does as well?
Just legume in Switzerland.
Comes into season in the second week of June.
I'm not sure, but Switzerland, maybe he's just got a hankering for cheese.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Yes, thank you very much to Science in Sport for sponsoring the Cycling Podcast. We played our first response to a listener question last week from Rob Child from Science in Sport. We're about to play the second one. Questions are still coming in. Do send them in. If you've got any questions for the pros as well, contact at thecyclingpodcast.com. But here is me asking Rob Child another listener's question. So our question this week is from Jason Phipps. Hi, chaps. I could do with a little science and sport advice. I'm trying to lose weight. Who isn't? I that's him saying that, by the way, not me, but I am saying it too. I regularly commute into town by bike, 13.7 miles. Thank you, Strava. It takes an hour and a bit. Don't judge me. There are about 45 traffic pedestrian lights. Can you suggest a post-journey snack supplement that I can take rather than the sausage or bacon or sausage and bacon baguette that I usually have? Much appreciated.
Taking 20 to 30 grams of high-quality protein post-ride would really help with your weight loss. And more importantly, losing fat and gaining or maintaining muscle. So in effect, you tone up. Whey protein is a lot more satiating than other proteins, so you feel fuller for longer. And it also helps you build muscle as well, which will increase your overall metabolic rate, which again will help with weight loss. So ideal products to add into your diet would be things like Science in Sport whey protein, Science in Sport advanced isolate. And if you wanted something ultra convenient, then the Whey 20 gels provide 20 grams of fast digesting protein and they're ready to consume.
So that was Rob Child of Science in Sport. Reminder, you can get 25% off all your Science in Sport products using the code SISCP25 at scienceinsport.com. Rob Child mentioned one of the Science Sport products there, the Whey Gel, and Science Sport are offering that to Cycling Podcast listeners. It's essential for muscle repair. Science Sport's innovative new Whey 20 Gel provides 20 grams of protein and 6 grams of BCAAs in a zero-fat, low-sugar, low-carbohydrate gel. Cycling Podcast listeners can try 5 for £5, including free UK postage, by going to scienceandsport.com/get545. That's get 5 for 5 with the numbers 5. And the offer ends on the 30th of April 2018. That's in a couple of weeks. scienceandsport.com/get545. Go there and claim your 5 gels for £5. And thanks once again to Science and Sport. I was looking up vegetables in season in June for Simon Spielak, and I think he is Simon Spring Onion. Simon Spring Onion.
That's got a different name in the US, hasn't it?
A spring onion?
Yeah.
Is that called, scallion?
Is that? A scallion is a spring onion, I think.
Oh my goodness me. You're really testing us here, Daniel.
Yeah. Anyway, US listeners, write in.
Simon Scallion. We're going to look ahead to Liège-Bastogne-Liège in a moment, but we've been watching a bit of the Tour of the Alps as well, which has been a very entertaining race, hasn't it? Astana strong on that front as well, you know, after their win at Amstel Gold Race. They're having a very, very strong season, which is funny because they lost Fabio Aru and they looked a little bit short, or a little bit thin, their squad, but they've really stepped up this year and performing really well. What have you seen at the Tour of the Alps, Daniel? I mean, I think Thibaut Pinot, who we've not seen a lot of this season, has looked very good indeed.
The first thing that struck me, Rich, not just watching the Tour of the Alps, but a few races in the last 3 or 4 weeks, has been that we moan a lot about the calendar and how it's not coherent and how, you know, it's a big dog's dinner. But these 2 or 3 weeks of the season have actually been very enjoyable from that point of view, where we've seen this sort of transition from the Cobble Classics. And then we had, you know, a great race like the Trobriand-Lyon at the weekend, which is kind of tagged on the end a week after Paris-Roubaix. And then we go into the Ardennes. And it's been a bit of a feast for the watching fan. I mean, the Tour of the Alps has just looked fantastic. And it's the perfect warm-up for spectators as well for the Giro. My antennae were twitching yesterday. Lionel said, you know, do I take umbrage at the name of the Tour of the Alps? Well, no, but yesterday the Tour of the Alps went to Alpe di Pampiago, and that was in the Dolomites, curiously enough. As for the racing, yeah, Pino looks really, really good. He's not raced a lot this year. Yesterday was his 10th race day of the year. He's been doing an awful lot of cross-country skiing, actually, this winter. Not sure how that's going to shake out as preparation for the Giro, but he certainly looks good at the moment. Froome he's had his difficult moments on the climbs, but he's really riding in typical Chris Froome fashion. He was getting dropped early on the Alpe di Pampiago climb and then recovered and was looking pretty good by the end. And then Superman Lopez of Astana is going to be a real Tricky customer when we get to the Giro. He won the stage at Alpe di Pampiago, and he's increasingly looking like, of all of the Colombian climbers, probably the most explosive of the pure Colombian climbers. And he could, well, he said that he wants to finish on the podium, or he'd love to finish on the podium at the Giro. And at the moment, I would suggest he's looking just as good a bet for that as the likes of Fabio Aru.
Yeah, Chris Froome has looked pretty erratic, but I think he's not going to... He looks to have his racer's instinct intact. He certainly had a good go today's stage on the descent. He's not going to give up easily, but... You know, if you look at the way these guys are climbing, and yesterday's, that's Tuesday's stage, was a really hard climb up to finish, and Froome did seem to be lacking something there. And Pino definitely was stronger, and Lopez in the end was stronger too. But you know, these guys will go toe to toe at the Giro, and it's, you know, as you say, it's a bit of a rehearsal. But you know, Froome will have to be better at the Giro if he's gonna. If he's going to win it, he's done that before, of course. But
bearing in mind, Rich, yeah, that we haven't really seen Tom Dumoulin yet, we're not really sure what shape he's in. I mean, how do you think they're sort of stacking up at the moment, the favourites for the Giro? Because you got Froome, Dumoulin, Chavez. We haven't really seen. He's in Colombia. We're hoping to speak to him actually tomorrow from Colombia. Mm. He's also targeting the Giro.
Well, you'd have to say, on the evidence of this week, Pino looks really good, and he went close to the podium last year, of course, because Fabio Aru is also looking fallible, not looking great. The two leaders at UAE Team Emirates, Dan Martin and Fabio Aru, both having quite difficult starts to the year, not really clicking. And Aru looks, well, Aru always looks like he's struggling, doesn't he, really? But he hasn't looked particularly strong. I think Froome will be better. Froome will be better, and Froome's got the experience. But Pino is an interesting prospect for the Giro.
I mean, I would agree with you. He's coming in. He's deliberately coming into the Giro very fresh. I mentioned how little he's raced. That's partly with a view to also doing the Tour de France in a better state than he did it last year. He was very tired when he went in last year. But also with Pino, as you mentioned, he rode that really good race last year, despite having ridden quite a poor time trial in Umbria. And of course, prior to that, the year or two prior to that, he'd been impressing us with his time trialing. So, you know, if he, we don't expect him to beat Tom Dumoulin or even get particularly close in a time trial, but if he can stay fairly close to Dumoulin in a time trial, you would expect him to drop him here and there in the mountains in the Giro. But so I think he's got a good chance, but, you know, speculation.
It is speculation, but I certainly think Miguel Angel Lopez won't be too upset with having a win at this stage of the season. Remember last year, he was kind of the man of the race in the second half of the Vuelta, wasn't he? He won a couple of stages in the back half of the race and looked very good every time the climbs came along. He was already kind of out of the overall picture by that stage, and I don't think his time trialing is particularly, you know, A1, but he has won the Tour of Switzerland in the past. You know, he's obviously a stage race animal and still only 24 or 25 years old. So, you know, inexperienced and kind of, you know, fresh in the grand scheme of things. So could be, you know, a big rider to watch in the Giro.
They're also, Napalm, going to have a really strong team, Astana, at the Giro. They've had a brilliant couple of weeks, but they've already earmarked Luis Leon Sanchez, Tanel Kanga and Davide Villela to help Lopez at the Giro. And there's a lot of experience there, a lot of firepower. I was reminded today, chaps, that when Nibali was away with Tanel Kanga briefly, they ride for different teams now, of course. Nibali is at Bahrain Merida. But I always used to snigger when Nibali would name check Tanel Kanga in press conferences when they were teammates. When Kanga was his best domestique and someone he was riding sort of side by side with next day, he always used to say his name in interviews as though he'd just met him for the first time. Tanel Kangert.
About former Pedler de Charme as well, of course, Tanel Kangert. We've got a picture of him in his Pedler de Charme t-shirt. We'll look ahead a bit to Liège Bastogne-Liège, but not too much, because we've just today, just as Flesh Alone finished, we've released our latest Friends special, The Trouble with La Doyenne. It's an hour-long episode looking at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. There's some history in there. There's some interviews. We've got Dan Martin, there's Jack Hagen there, Michele Bartoli is in there. Nico Matan is in there talking about the late Frank Vandenbroek and his win in 1999. And it's pretty comprehensive. As the title suggests, we also discuss what we believe to be a slight problem with
Leeds. We're quite negative, aren't we?
I wouldn't say... Yes.
Well, when it comes to Liège-Bastogne-Liège and its history, it's better to be negative than positive in some respects.
One might argue. Yeah, well.
There was a run of very positive years. From the sort of mid-90s onwards.
That's one of the issues that we talk about. But we talk a little bit about, you know, what the race is and what it could and should be, maybe. I mean, but if you want to hear an hour of us moaning, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. It's not all like that. There's some light hot moments in there.
Yeah, hot on the heels of 45 minutes of moaning. I mean,
in case you haven't had your enough moaning this week. No, thecyclingpodcast.com. Thanks to everyone who has signed up already as a friend of the podcast. Costs £15 for the year. Got a few in the works at the moment, friends specials. So this is the latest one. And pretty comprehensive look at Liège-Bastogne-Liège, the last big one-day classic of the spring. And, you know, after Flesh Wallonne today, when Alejandro Valverde has been beaten, he'll still go into the race, I'm sure, as the favourite on Sunday. But it could be a little bit more open, couldn't it?
Well, I think the point you made, Rich, about the team size is if it's ever going to play a role, that the fact that there are only seven riders per team now instead of eight, it's going to be in Liège, because Liège is a brutal, very long, very hilly one-day race. And for the favourites, for Valverde, it's going to be quite difficult to ration his teammates and decide where they're respectively going to work. And, you know, they might come under a bit of pressure. I think we got a bit of a taste of that today. Movistar, they've got targets on their back, and they probably won't get too many favours from other teams. Although Alaphilippe's win today in Flesh might help them in that regard. Quickstep will have almost the same amount of responsibility, I would suggest.
Well, it's going to be a bright, warm day. It might be a bit of cloud cover, but it looks like it's going to be pretty warm like it was today. So over 6+ hours, that will also take its toll a little bit. Unlike, a couple of years ago when Wout Poels won, it was practically snowing, or it was snowing at parts, wasn't it? I think the weather that day was am I right? That was terrible, wasn't it? That's
yep,
the last
yep, yep.
really terrible one. In terms of Alejandro Valverde, obviously a four-time winner of Liège-Bastogne-Liège, won two of the last 3 years. I spoke to some fairly well-known and well-connected Belgians over the last couple of days, and they were absolutely purring about Valverde at Amstel Gold, saying he was by far the strongest in the race, and really couldn't see him being beaten today in Flesh Wallonne. That, of course, turned out not to be the case. Valverde was toppled from the summit of the Mur de Huy. We shall see whether... The thing about him is that he doesn't just have the strength, he does have the racecraft as well. And we saw that when he came to the line with Dan Martin last year. You know, it was a little bit like watching a sort of a veteran cat play with a mouse. The way he kind of toyed with it and got the result he wanted.
Any picks then? Are we going to put our necks on the line here or not? Have we learned our lesson?
Worth maybe mentioning a couple of outsiders, Rich. Michael Woods had a very good, I think it was his first Liège-Bastogne-Liège last year, the American rider for EF Education. He was ninth. He seemed to be in pretty good position on the Mur de Huy today, but I'm not sure exactly where he finished. I imagine he was in the top 20. And also I think Fuglsang will do a good ride. He was another one who looked pretty good on the Mur de Huy, and in light of Astana's recent form, I think... He should go pretty well.
And what about our old friend Vincenzo Nibali? I mean, it's a race that he has said that he was targeting, and he's obviously going pretty well. And it's a race that should suit him.
Well, it should. I think he should be the second favourite behind Valverde, I would suggest. I mean,
but he's not going to win it on a, you know, in a straight up kind of sprint with Valverde, is he? He's got to get away a bit earlier.
Yeah, correct. And you know, we talk in our special. It's sort of been forgotten really in the last 3 or 4 years, but this special bond that the Italians have with Liège-Bastogne-Liège, partly due to the history of the Ardennes region and the Italian miners that came over after the Second World War, in particular. But you know, there have been periods of Liège-Bastogne-Liège's recent history that have been completely dominated by the Italians, and they probably more than the Spaniards and more than other nations really sort of get a sense of occasion when they're riding La Doyenne.
I think Michael Matthews, had a pretty tricky spring so far. Broke a collarbone, collarbone, wasn't it, in Omloop, Het Nieuwsblad. He rode Milan-San Remo, but didn't really figure. But fifth today on the Mur de Huy, and was fourth last year in Liège-Bastogne-Liège. You forget just what a, you know, what endurance he's got, and I think what would be the odds on an all Michael podium? Michael Woods, Michael Matthews, and Mikhail Kwiatkowski, or Michael Albasini.
Wow, a lot of Michaels. a lot of Michaels. It's a race that suits Michael.
I was thinking today we might get a 1-2 of Martins, because I thought Guillaume Martin of Wanty-Gobert has been riding incredibly well recently, and he was talking about hoping to finish in the top 10. And then Dan Martin, of course, was one of the favourites, but didn't go too well for him.
Well, absolutely. I mean, this is pathetic, but I'm actually looking down through the list to see if a Michael has ever won Liège-Bastogne-Liège. These are the sorts of facts that... Michele Bartoli, is he a Michael?
Oh, yeah, absolutely.
Not really. I think there's never been a Michael who's won Liège-Bastogne-Liège. So we could witness real history on Sunday. Something to look forward to. Michael Valgren.
I'm going for a top five of Michaels, and I'm going to put a pound on that.
Okay. I should say that the discussion around Liège-Bastogne-Liège in our friend's special is much better than this.
Much higher brow, isn't it? Much higher brow.
Especially the stuff about the links between Italy and Belgium. I didn't really know that, and I found that very interesting. I should also say that the artwork for our latest friend's special was supplied by Massif Central, a designer based in London. And it looks very nice, looks beautiful. So if you see the slide on social media, it's from Massif Central. And thanks to Howard Smith for that. He is a friend of the podcast. And you'll see more of their work at themassifcentral.co.uk, themassifcentral.co.uk. Yes, our latest friend special now available, looking ahead to Liège-Bastogne-Liège on Sunday. It's called The Trouble with La Doyenne. Let's hear a short clip from it now. It's the oldest of the five monuments, having first been held in 1892. It's known as La Doyenne or Loic Bastakanen, Loic as they say in the Flemish-speaking part of Belgium. It's often described as the hardest one-day race in the world. It starts in Liège, goes to Bastogne, and then heads back by a more circuitous and hilly route to Liège, more or less. And of course, it's called Liège-Bastogne-Liège.
Qui va commencer? Merckx toujours en tête, Gottfried, toujours Merckx. Eh bien, entre Merckx et Verbeek, c'est très juste.
Frank van den Broek is going to love this now. Cocky was he at the start when he said he would win. It doesn't appear that way now.
Et c'est Argentine! Secondo Griquillon, terzo Saracen, e quarto...
Valverde is also involved and suddenly just turns on the afterburners here. Oh, this is absolutely superb. He just drives this away. Is he going to bring this one home? It certainly looks like it. Danny Martin is hitting out here.
I mean, it possibly means more to me now than it did back then, because obviously it's had time to sink in, but obviously I think since then I've realised how difficult it is to win the age.
Sean Kelly says, yes, absolutely, join my party. And Daniel Martin has won today in the most emphatic style.
We should wrap things up there, fellas. Before we do, just a couple of other bits of business. One thing actually is to point anyone who's interested to Lionel's award-winning blog. well, it's not award winning yet, but you know, I'm sure it will be. But Lionel, you wrote a very interesting blog this week about the sort of funding model for the cycling podcast and the advertising that we have in the podcast. We have a little bit more this year for various reasons, and you explain it all very clearly and interestingly in your blog. So that's at lionelburney.com, isn't it?
It is lionelburney.com/blog. Yeah, just I saw a review on iTunes criticising the amount of advertising, and I just felt, well, why
still
not
our most recent review. Come on, guys, bump it down a bit.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, push it down so no one can see.
Get your pens out.
But I thought rather than ignore it, I'd draw everyone's attention to it by writing a 2,000-word blog. But no, I just thought, well, why not just explain why we have advertising? I mean, people might not know. So if they read that, they will understand, you know, why that is. You know, we have to fund what we do some way, and that is the... Well, it's a jigsaw of funding, isn't it? But it's all in the blog. If you're interested, go and have a read.
And finally, I want to abuse my position. This isn't advertising as such, but I contacted pancreaticcancer.org.uk recently. My mother passed away from pancreatic cancer 13 years ago now, and I got an email back from them. Weirdly, they've got people in their office who listen to the cycling podcast, so that was nice to hear from them. And they invited me in and got me involved in helping with their fundraising efforts, and particularly focused on the cycling side around Ride London. They have places in Ride London. If you want to ride it, you can register through pancreaticcancer.org.uk. There's also a training day on the 12th of May in Surrey. I'll be going along to that and being absolutely humiliated, no doubt, on my bike. That's why I was out today, training, secret training. But you can get involved in that if you fancy riding Ride London, if you fancy coming to training day on the 12th of May. Details at pancreaticcancer.org.uk. Go to events there.
Rich,
I think that's
Rich,
all for
just,
this week.
Just one,
sorry,
one final stop press postscript just to dash Napalm's hopes of an all Michael top five. Michael Woods was actually 33rd today. We've just had the results from Flesh well on, so that wasn't quite as good as I thought. Doesn't look to be in particularly
Saving it all for Sunday.
Well, yeah, I mean, these are races that definitely should suit him, but I think the Giro is a big target for him this year, so he might just be coming to the boil a little bit later, who knows. But yeah, I'm quite surprised to see him not a little bit further up today. Anyway, we should wrap things up for this week. Thank you very much in our Brussels bureau there, Lionel Burney.
Thank you, Richard.
And in Berlin, thank you, Daniel.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Cycling Podcast. If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us and leave a review on Facebook and iTunes. Just search online for the Cycling Podcast. This episode was edited and produced by Matt Field.